Good morning, everyone. These lines, which we just heard, Mother and Sunilda's music, come from the beginning of Book 2, Canto 3, in which Asvapati starts to explore the worlds of life. And he enters the worlds of life on our level. He sees all the uncertainty and willfulness, the contrasts, the drama of life as we know. But at the end of the first section, Sri Aurobindo, that this is not the true nature of life. That life has a divine origin, and let me find the place. Beauty and happiness are her native right, and endless bliss is her eternal home. Sri Aurobindo wants us to recognize the divine origin of life, that it's not something to be rejected or turned away from, and the life principle isn't something which we should be aiming to cut out of our own nature. And in the rest of the canto, he was shown this higher world, the true origin of life, the higher worlds. And we saw some of the different levels there. And then we come to the section, the last section, which tells us that Asvapati could see this world of bliss, the native home of truth, but he wasn't able to enter into it. And that was because his nature was still too close to our human nature, which is tied down to doubt and uncertainty. Even our substance ties us down. And how has this come about? That's what we were reading about last week, how in the beginning of the earthly creation there was no life, no play of mind, no desire of the heart, but earth was inhabited by a race of young gods, divine beings who had entered the evolution and were identified with the material earth, purely material earth, identified with sea and sky and stone. And as the eons passed, those young gods began to yearn for more possibilities of consciousness. Purely material expression was not enough for them. They felt the load of Godhead weighing them down in this world that had no needs, this purely material, apparently unconscious world. They began to long for the movements of a conscious heart, famishing for speech. Famishing is a very strong word in English. It means starving. You have to eat, otherwise you will die. Famishing for speech and thought and joy and love. In the dumb, insensitive, whirling day and night, they hungered or the beat of yearning and response. This is the intense aspiration of those young gods We're on page 129 at line 482. So Sri Aurobindo and the mother tell us repeatedly that where there's an intense aspiration, there will always be a response from above. So in response to that intense aspiration of the young gods, identified with the earth, taking care of the earth in its very early stages of evolution, something happens. There's a change. We're on page 129, line 482. We're almost at the end of book 2, canto 3, which is called The Glory and the Fall of Life. Sri Aurobindo has shown us some of life in her fallen state and of the glorious native worlds of life unfallen. And now he's going to tell us about how life on earth has become what it is. This will be the theme of the coming cantos. Now we would just get an introduction into that theme. It will only be in canto 9 that we're able to follow King Aswapati into the paradise of the life gods. He will spend a short time there and then he will move on. But first Sri Aurobindo is going to show us in canto 4 and 5 and 6, 7 and 8 the evolutionary movements that have led to life as we know it and which give the promise of higher possibilities.
So, if I go, as you said, that before any life on earth, the early gods were inhabiting.
They were what?
Gods were inhabiting the earth.
Yes, they were identified with the material earth, yes.
So then this beginning of life, this after this big time, all these things happened, then immediately life started, there was a breach between that.
Yes, actually what he's going to show us is that this movement of aspiration and then a corresponding descent by grace that will lead to a complete change, that the earth will no longer be purely material. So we can start reading about that now. You can start.
The boys in conscience shaken with a touch, the entity of silence trembling with a name. They cry to light to invade the senseless moon, and it forms a way. A voice was heard, and the new rolling blur. A murmur moaned in the unlistening world. A being seemed to breathe. A being seemed to breathe where once was none. Something pent up in dead insentient depths, denied conscious existence, lost to joy, turned as if one asleep since dateless time. Aware of its own buried reality, remember its forgotten self and right, it yearned to know, to aspire, to enjoy, to live. Life recalled and left her native light, overflowing from her bright, magnificent plane, and the rigid coil and sprawl of mortal space, here too the gracious grace.
So first the aspiration and then the response. We can see a parallel between these last lines on page 129 and the very beginning of the poem, the beginning of book 1, canto 1, where at the bottom of the first page, after describing this state of darkness, resistance to the light, which prevails at the beginning of the poem. He says it's like the beginning of the universe. But then something in the inscrutable darkness stirred. There's a movement. A nameless movement, an unthought idea, insistent, dissatisfied, without an aim, something that wished but knew not how to be, teased the inconscient to wake ignorance. A throw, a little movement that came and left a quivering trace, gave room for an old, tired want, unfilled, at peace in its subconscious moonless cave, to raise its head and look for absent light. Straining closed eyes of vanished memory, like one who searches for a bygone self and only meets the corpse of his desire. In the complete blackness and unconsciousness, something moves and longs for a higher state without even knowing what it is that it's longing for. And it's in response to that little movement that the first light of dawn comes and things begin to wake up. So similarly here in the material world, something buried deep within aspires for a more conscious state, aspires intensely, famishing.
Does it also relate to what Mother talks in, I think, when she arrived first, when saw through a window, when the whole earth immersed in darkness, no matter when, whom I saw last night?
I don't know exactly what you're referring to, Ram Narayan, but it's one of her prayers and meditations. Yes.
So when there is light, then all the darkness is there, no problem, and ease there. Since there is the darkness.
Well, of course, that's the message of this whole poem, that within all the apparent darkness, a truth supreme has made this world. And that light is there, and because that light is there, whatever the appearances we must bear, whatever even though everything seems just drift, without purpose, meaningless, aimless, and bale, misery and misfortune. Someone is still keeping an eye on it all. One who has made this world is ever its Lord, and he's going to make sure that everything reaches its divine fulfillment. So here what happens is that in response to that aspiration into the material world, the goddess of life pours her wonderful being into it, no? Her splendor and her swiftness and her bliss. So let's read on from there. Would you read? As comes a goddess.
As comes a goddess to a mortal's breast, and fills his days with her celestial bliss. She stooped to make her more imagined shapes. In matter's womb she cast the immortal spark. In the unfeeling vast world thought and hope. Smote with her charm and beauty flesh and mirror, and forced delight on earth's insensible. Alive and clad with trees and herbs and flowers, Earth's great brown body smiled, calls the skies. Azure replied to azure, and the seas laugh. New sentient creatures filled the unseen depths, as glory and swiftness ran in the beauty of beasts. Man dared and thought and met with his soul the world.
Yes, thank you. So these are the results of the descent of life into the purely material universe. Anybody would like to ask anything about this passage?
Why it says unfeeling
lust?
Well, senses, the capacity to sense and feel and to feel emotion, these are powers of life. Purely material things don't seem to have these capacities. Or if the capacity is there, the instruments are not there, the senses are not there, by which those capacities could be expressed. So if we think of a purely material universe, it's sea and sky and stone, but no feeling, no life. Sri Aurobindo starts this passage with an image. He says, it's like when a goddess comes to a mortal's breast and fills his days with her celestial clasp. This is a spiritual experience, and it's one that Sri Aurobindo has expressed in some of his poems, and particularly the one Pururavas and Urvasi, the story of King Pururavas and Urvasi, how an apsara falls in love with a mortal. So that can happen. It's an experience Sri Aurobindo must have had. It's expressed in different places in the poem. the descent of a divine being embracing a human being and changing the whole quality of his life by her embrace. So in a similar way, he says, it's the spirit of life, the gracious, great winged angel has poured all her splendor and her swiftness and her bliss onto the material world, hoping to fill a new world with joy.
Fair
means beautiful. And actually this little phrase is a kind of echo. We find these kind of echoes from English literature throughout the poem here and there. It's nice when we can recognize them. The English epic poet Milton has written an epic poem called Paradise Lost, in which, in one of his cantos, he describes the creation of the world, how beautiful the world was when God first made it. And he refers to it as a brave new world, a world full of life and possibilities. Here, Sri Aurobindo says, a fair new world. The life goddess wants to create a beautiful new world filled with joy. And so she pours down all her gifts, stoops from her high home, she bends down to make her home in transient shapes, not immortal forms, passing material shapes. In matter's womb, she cast the immortal's fire, the fire of immortality and life. So in this unfeeling vast of the material world, she woke up thought and hope. And with her charm and beauty, she gives a blow to the flesh and nerve of living creatures and forced delight on Earth's insensible frame. If we think of Earth as one of the five primal elements, Earth represents the element of matter, which in itself doesn't seem to have the capacity of sense perception. So it is insensible. But she forces this insensible frame of matter to wake up to delight. And that brings a great change in our world, which consisted of sea and sky and stone and volcanoes and purely material manifestations. But now the earth becomes alive, clothed with trees and herbs and flowers. It's as if this great brown body of earth smiles towards the skies. Look how beautiful I am. No. He says, azure replied to azure in the sea's laugh. Azure is blue. And if the sea is dancing, we can think it is the blue of the sea is laughing at the blue of the sky. Of course, that was going on before, but there was nobody to notice or enjoy that there's a laughter there. There was no consciousness. But now, new sentient creatures with the capacity of feeling, filled the unseen depths, even the depths of the ocean. life's glory and swiftness ran in the beauty of beasts, and even eventually man emerged and dared. Daring means doing something that you may be difficult and challenging. Animals don't seem to have this consciousness. They just do things automatically. It's not that they have to overcome their fears or anything like that. But man dared and thought and met with his soul, the world, all the challenges presented by the world. So this is a very great change represented by the coming of the life goddess into the material universe.
We have a question about the 5-5. I am not found in the matter room. She casts the immortal fire. Immortal fire is when you put every dirty disease in agony.
Well, that would
your
be.
Your body burns. Is immortal fire?
I think when you use the immortal fire, you use the power of Agni for purification.
Yeah.
But here it is something else. It is life is injecting this this fire, which gives the possibility of feeling and delight. And she is injecting that into matter.
Okay.
Yeah, it's something slightly different. Yeah. Patricia, would you read?
But while the magic breath was on its way, before her gifts could reach our prisoned hearts, a dark, ambiguous presence questioned all. A secret will that robes itself with night and offers to spirit the ordeal of the flesh, imposed a mystic dance of death and pain, interned now in the slow and suffering years, sojourns the winged and wonderful wayfarer, and can no more recall her happier state, but must obey the inert inconscience law, incense the foundation of a world in which blind limits are on beauty laid, and sorrow and joy as struggling comrades live.
Thank you. We have to meditate on this. There she is, pouring all her possibilities of delight on the material world. But that's not our experience. Something has happened. And throughout human history, there has been the feeling that something went wrong. Some traditions blame it on human beings, that it was Adam and Eve, the first human beings. They disobeyed God, and it's because of them that we've been expelled from paradise. That's not quite the explanation that Sri Aurobindo gives. Here he says that there's a secret will that robes itself with night, it covers itself with darkness and unconsciousness. And what that secret will does is to offer to spirit the ordeal of the flesh. An ordeal, a painful test, a challenge. What is that secret will, and why does it do that? Why does it challenge spirit with this ordeal of material life? All the limitations and, he says, indignities of mortal life. That will, that spirit, has imposed a mystic mask of death and pain on life in the material universe. So again, this reminds us of something in the early cantos of the poem, if I can find it. I think it must be in second section of Canto 1. Sri Aurobindo says that there is one who challenges the great. Sorry, I should have noted this earlier.
And one that barred the way?
Yes. Page 17. Yes. On the top of page 17, thank you, Jocelyn. Sri Aurobindo says that there is a darkness in terrestrial things, in earthly things, that won't allow too glad a note for very long. And even on Savitri, who's come absolutely pure into the world, carrying with her all the memory and the delight of her origin, on her too closed that inescapable hand. She faced this darkness. She's an armed immortal, but she has to bear the snare, the trap of time. One dealt with her who meets the burdened great, the great souls who come with a mission and a responsibility. They have to face this one. He's the one who assigns the ordeal and the path, and who chooses in this earthly life, in this holocaust of the soul, in this life which is an offering, a sacrifice of the soul, he chooses death, fall, and sorrow as the spirit's goads. A goad is something that makes you go faster. The mahout has a special goad for poking the elephant to make it go. Or a horse rider has spurs on his feet. Or even a bullock driver, he will have a sharp stick. He pokes the bullock. That's a goad. And we human beings also, we need goads to make us progress. We need poking because, of course, we love comfort and ease. So he says even the spirit needs goals. It needs some impulse to push it forward, to take necessary steps. So, Amalkiran, who wrote so many letters to Sri Aurobindo about Savitri, I wrote one about these lines also. And he said, who is this one? Is it love? Is it pain? Is it time? What is it? And Sri Aurobindo said, I deliberately haven't said, given it a name. But he said, if you like, you can think of it as the Lord of evolution. It's the power that drives things forwards. So that's the thing about paradise. Even in the ancient Hebrew tradition, the occult significance of the serpent in paradise, it's said to be that this is actually the force of evolution driving things forward, the rainbow-colored serpent. So if life had just poured all its gifts, but it's poured all that onto the material universe, how is this combination of actually completely contradictory qualities of life and matter, how is that going to get worked out? No? This has to get worked out in evolution by spirit. So this dark, ambiguous presence, this pressure of evolution, which is difficult to understand, that secret will that disguises itself. Sorry?
The one.
Yes.
The Lord
of evolution. Then what?
We can say this is also a similar idea of élan vital.
Of the élan vital.
Or different.
You know this expression, the élan vital? This was the label chosen by the French philosopher Henri Bergson, who had a rather different view of human progress and of evolution from Sri Aurobindo, but there are some similarities. Our sister Esther, when she did her thesis at the Sorbonne in the 50s, she made a comparison between Sri Aurobindo's ideas of evolution and Bergson's élan vital, this vital drive. I think from the point of view of Sri Aurobindo's teachings, the vital drive would be only one part, one element in the evolutionary drive. But here that's a bit what we are seeing with the descent of life into matter. How is that life force going to wake up in matter and carry evolution forward? And that's definitely the theme of the next canto, in canto 4, which we're going to read. So we can say there's some connection or similarity between Bergson's idea, but like most people's ideas, it's incomplete compared with Sri Aurobindo's great synthetic view, which seems to have room in it for everything that anybody else has thought and written about.
Instead of life force, if we can aspire for spiritual force, it
yes.
looks like it can fit into everything. Do you think that that can do the wonder?
Yes, I think that's what we believe in. No? We believe in the supreme conscious force, the mother, giving birth to everything in the world. But she becomes life force, she expresses herself as the life goddess. Who else is this now pouring her gifts in her life aspect? Later on we'll see her expressing herself in the different levels of mind and in the as the soul. Behind all those different principles and powers, there's the Chit Shakti, the Supreme Conscious Force. So let's go on. What happens when this dark, ambiguous presence questions all? Dhanalakshmi, will you read?
In time and now, in the slow and the suffering years, sojourns the winged and wonderful wayfarer, and can no more recall the happier state, but must obey the inconscient law. Insensible foundation of a world in which blind limits are on beauty laid, on sorrow and joy, as struggling comrades live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's pause there. So now the life force is interned, imprisoned in the slow and suffering years, in time. She was such a winged and wonderful wayfarer, free to move everywhere in the universe. Here on earth, she's imprisoned in matter. And in that state, she can't anymore even remember her happier state, her native home of bliss. Here, she has to obey the law of matter, the law of the inconscient. The inconscient, which is the foundation of this world. The insensible foundation, matter, as we've been saying, it doesn't seem to have the capacity for feeling, either sensation or emotion. So, we live in a world in which blind limits are laid on beauty, and sorrow and joy as struggling comrades live, like opposites, twins. Would you like to read?
A dim and dreadful meekness fell on her. Abolished was her subtle, mighty spirit, and slain her womb of child god happiness, and all her glory into littleness turned, and all her sweetness into a maimed desire. To feed death with her works is here life's view. So veiled was her immortality that she seemed inflicting consciousness on unconscious things, an episode in an eternal death, a myth of being that must forever cease. Such was the evil mystery of her change.
Yes.
Because mystic for me is more spiritual.
Yes.
And here it looks like it's used dark.
I think it's not meant as something negative, but something mysterious. And it's a mask, it's only a disguise after all. But it's a bit like the man in the iron mask, he's imprisoned behind that mask, no? In the world of matter. Life has to express itself through material means, and they are very contradictory. with the true original characteristics of life, freedom, variety, delight. No. This insensible mask imposes these limits on life's self-expression in the material world. And that brings about this duality of emotions and feelings, which are typical of life as we know it. And that wonderful gift, her boon of child-god happiness, we've lost that when we think about losing paradise. That's what we lost, that spontaneous happiness. All her glory into littleness turned, and all her sweetness into a maimed desire, a desire which is somehow impure and wounded. Here, what we see as a phenomenon in our world is that life is feeding death. We were reading about it in Essays on the Gita recently. In the material world, all material forms just feed on other material forms. Life seems to depend on death. She, in her own world, she's an immortal goddess. But here, life seems to be inflicting consciousness on unconscious things. We think that, oh, maybe it's a happier state to be unconscious. Consciousness is too difficult, it's too painful. And life is just an episode, a short episode of consciousness and action, some enjoyment, some suffering, in a state of eternal death. This life that we live seems perhaps to be something like a myth that can't last long. That's what we shall see death arguing at the end of the poem. That this thing you call life and existence and consciousness, it doesn't really exist, it's just a myth, an illusion. So this is the evil mystery that has come about at this first stage of the union of life with matter. It's a step, a very, very important and significant step in the evolutionary process. But its first results look very discouraging, we can say. And it's that discouragement that Shobindo will show to us next in the early sections of the next canto. Yes, Margaret?
In this line, and slain her boon of childhood happiness, in my perception and experience, many children have still this happiness, and when they go on their adult life, they lose this.
Yes, the experience, through the experiences of life, we all lose it in one way or another.
Yeah.
It's very, very unusual to find someone who hasn't lost it.
Yeah. And then also it says here in the Bible to become as the children.
Yes, to become like little children. But it's not so easy to get back to that state of child-god happiness, of spontaneous youthful delight. But it's an ideal for us, isn't it? When we think about paradise, that's one of the prime qualities of spontaneous, innocent enjoyment. Fortunately.
No, but I mean, also for us, it's not completely inaccessible, that state.
Yes.
That's right, because that's the natural state of the soul. So if we get in touch with our soul, then we can again experience that. Yes.
Child-god happiness, it reminds me of
Yes. Yes. He experienced. Yes. 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 That's why it's really worthwhile to to find our true selves, which has this boon of child God happiness, as well as many other boons.
And that's also behind the mother's advice for the education of the children, not to cut them off of their
yes.
soul, their happiness.
Yes. Right.
I did the last 3 days a yoga program, and there's one young person, he's grown up in the ashram. It is his grandparents went to the ashram school, his parents and he also. So it's amazing what is this person navigating here and living here. Such a joy.
So it's about 11:30. Shall we read the first section or first sections of the next canto? Page 132. Sorry?
I said the three first sections
are quite short, yes. So let's see how much we can read. Prasad, you want to read?
Maybe not.
Maybe not. Okay. Betty.
Canto 4, the Kingdom of the New Life. A quivering, trepidant, uncertain world, born from that dolorous meeting and eclipse, appeared in the emptiness where her feet had trod. A quick obscurity, a seeking stir. There was a writhing of half-conscious force, hardly awakened from the unconscious sleep, tied to an instinct-driven ignorance, to find itself and find its hold on things. The inheritor of poverty and loss, assailed by memories that fled when seized, haunted by a forgotten, uplifting hope, it strove with a blindness as of groping hands to fill the aching and disastrous gap between earth pain and the bliss from which life fed.
Thank you. Gunilla, will you read?
A world that never seeks for somethingness haunts for the joy of the earth that has paid to keep. Too near our gates is appeared unless for peace to live in the universe solid globe. It has joined its hunger to the hunger of the earth. It has given a low craving to our lives. It has made our spirit be fat in the skull. An infamous entity in the shadow, mortal night and day, a shadow overcast.
All right. It's so.
In the troubled stream where leaps a black heart holds, and the nerve beat of feeling wakes in sense, dividing matters from conscious mind. Restrain the call that we know to life gain. Power beyond the hope has touched yours. The repose that might have been can be normal, formless yearning, stations in man's heart. A cry isn't his blood for happy things. Else could he roam on free sunny soul. With the childlike pain forgetting mind of beasts, or live happy and move like flowers and trees. The night that came upon the earth was
Jerry.
The animals, all of joy is left behind. Care and reflection burden his daily walk. He has risen to greatness and to discontent. He is awake to the invisible. Insatiate seeker, he has all to learn. He has exhausted now life's surface acts. His being's hidden realms remain to explore. He becomes mind, he becomes a spirit and self. In his fragile tenement, he grows nature's lord. In him, matter wakes from his long, obscure trance. In him, earth feels the Godhead drawing near.
Thank you. Turia.
Annihilate power, baptize no more its being, arrest hungry energy of greed. Life cast her seed in the body's infinite mood. It woke from happy to a war to blind force, compelling it to sense and seek and feel. In the enormous labor of the void, perturbing with her dreams the vast routine, and dead all of his slumbering universe, the mighty prisoner struggled for release. Alive with her yearning hope, the inner cell, in the heart she kindled a fire of passion and need. Amid the deep calm of inanimate things, arose her great voice of toil and prayer and strife. A groping consciousness in a voiceless world. A guideless sense was given her for her own. Thought was with her, and nothing now she knew. But all the unknown was hers, who keep and trust.
Thank you.
Obeying the push of unborn things towards birth, out of a seal of insentient life she broke. In her substance of unthinking mute soul strength, that cannot utter what its depth divine, awoke a blind necessity to know. The chain that bound her, she made her instrument. Instinct was hers, the chrysalis of truth. An effort and growth and striving nestles. Inflicting on the body desire and hope, imposing on unconscious consciousness, she brought into matter's dull tenacity her anguished claim to her lost sovereign right, her tireless search, her vexed, uneasy heart, her wandering, unsure steps, her cry for change. A door of a joy without a name, sorry.
A door of a joy without a name, in her obscure cathedral of delight, to dim dwarf gods she offered secret rites, that vain, unending is the sacrifice. The priest, an ignorant mage, who only makes futile mutations in the altar's square, and casts blind hopes into a powerless flame. The burden of transient gains weighs down the stem, and hardly under that load can she avail.
Ganga Lakshmi.
Matter dissatisfied, she turned to mind. She conquered her field, then claimed the events. Insensible, breaking the work she has done. The stumbling age of her level past, but still nobly transformed rock can bind. And no revealing rapture touch her face. Only a glimmer sometimes splits mind's sky, justify the ambiguous providence that makes of night a path to a new dawn, for a dark loop to some divine state. The nations began her mighty task. In ignorance, she pursued the unfinished work. For knowledge grows, but meet not wisdom's face. Ascending slowly, with unconscious step, the foundling of the God, she wanders here, like a child's soul left near the gate of hell, flumbling through fog in search of paradise.
Mm. Very poignant lines.
Yeah.
Will you read, please? I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name.
Yeah.
I know who you are, but I've forgotten your name.
In the slow ascension, he must follow her pace, even from her faint and dim subconscious start. So only could his last salvation come. For so only could he know the obscure cause of all that holds us back and baffles God. In the jail delivery of the imprisoned soul. Along swift paths of fall through dangerous gates, he chanced into a gray obscurity, teeming with instincts from the mindless hopes that push to wear a form and in a place.
Continue, please. A few more lines.
Life here was intimate with death and night, and ate death's food that she might breathe a while. She was their inmate, an adopted waif, accepting subconscious in dumb darkness's reign, a sojourner she hoped not anymore.
Mm, thank you. Karim.
There, far away from truth, the luminous thought, he saw the original seat, the separate birth. The dethroned, deformed, and suffering power. An unhappy face of falsity made truth, a true prediction of our divine birth. Indifferent to beauty and to light, parading, she flaunted her animal disgrace. Unhelped by camouflage, brutal, and bare. An authentic image, recognized and signed. Of her outcast force, exiled from heaven and hope. Fallen, glorying in the villainous of her state. The grovel of the strength, once half divine. The graceless squalor of her beast desires. The staring visage of her ignorance, the naked body of her poverty. Here first she crawled out from her cabin of mud, where she had lain inconscient, rigid, mute. Its narrowness and poor
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Lorraine.
A wide and quiet mist of seeking space, a rayless region swallowed in vague swaths that seemed unnamed, unembodied, and unhoused. A swallowed visionless and formless mind asked for a body to translate its soul. Its prayer denied, it fumbled after thought. As yet not powered to think, hardly to live, it opened to a weird and pygmy world where this unhappy magic had its source. On dim confines where life and matter met, it wandered among these, among things half seen, half guessed, pursued by ungrasped beginnings and lost ends. There life was born but died before it could live. There was no solid ground, no constant drift, only some plane of mindless will and power. Himself was dim to himself, half felt, obscure, as if in a struggle of the void to be. In strange domains where all was living sense, but mastering thought was not cause nor rule. Only a crude child heart cried for toys of bliss. Mind flickered, a disordered infant glow, and random shapeless energies drove towards form and took each crisp fire for a guiding sun.
Thank you. Leila.
This blindfold force could place no thinking step. Asking for light, she followed darkness through. An unconscious power grew towards consciousness. Matter smitten by matter in every sense. Blind contacts, slow reaction, vital sparks of instinct form, a closed subliminal bed. Sensations crowded, tongue substitute for thought. Perception answered nature's wavering blows, but still was a mechanical response. A jerk, a leap, a start in nature's dream. And rude, unjust, and impulses just in run. Heedless of every motion but their own, and darkly flashed with darker than themselves, free in a world of settled end.
Thank you. Will you read?
The need to exist, the instinct to survive, engrossed as precarious movements will, and an unseen desire felt out for food, the gust of nature with a hungry law, force resolved with force, with no result made, only were achieved in machines' grasp and life, and feelings and instincts know not their source, sense pleasures and sense pangs soon caught, soon lost, and grim motion of the thinking waves.
Lives. I think that's where we'll stop today, but we can look at the first line of the next section. It's always something a bit more encouraging. But judge not so, his spirit's wakened eyes. King Aswaspati sees things differently. we have some passages from this? Yes, let's hear them. Maybe you play the last one of Canto 3. Oh, okay.
In the garret of Sandrahu Vichichiku, he swept scores of 8 feet of circle, all swaying, she thought between her hands and me, uplifting all bulk on dying section. Above him, in a new celestial world, other than the heavens beheld by mortal eyes, and on a fretted ceiling of the god, an archipelago of laughter and fire, swam stars upon in a
Shri Aurobindo.